Unions and Democracy. Most people, I think, when they think about labor unions, don't think of this as a topic that's really central to democracy as such. If you were asked of what's the role of unions in an economy or a society, most people think of unions as an organization to advance the economic interests of their members, who are employees of firms and employees of the state. It's an economic organization, a labor market organization, whose primary effects and purposes and consequences are located in the economy. Rather than seeing unions as at their core a political organization, solving a certain kind of political problem. If it were a purely economic organization, it would be surprising that one of the first things that military dictatorships do when power is seized is abolish autonomous unions. There's a kind of checklist. If you look at military coups, what happens? Close down universities, or at least get rid of the leadership and a significant proportion of the professors in universities. Control the universities. Abolish the free press. But high on the list is control the unions. Either abolish them completely or replace them with unions that are clearly subordinated to the state. In the early 1980s in Poland, there was a union movement called Solidarity, some of you may have heard of it, which was absolutely at the core, the center of the movement of Polish people to reestablish democracy. And when there was a military coup to close it down, the first thing they did, number one on the list, was get rid of the union. The American government at that time, the Reagan administration, protested and argued for the centrality of free trade unions for democracy. So if unions were just an economic organization simply serving the interests, if they were the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce, the Chamber of Commerce is an organization of business people, particularly important in smaller cities. If this was just the Chamber of Commerce for employees, it would be kind of surprising if it was so high on the agenda for authoritarian, anti-democratic rule to get rid of them. So we're going to explore unions in this lecture primarily in terms of their connection to democracy. Here's the problem, for which then unions are one possible solution. The problem is this. In its simplest expression, democracy is rule by the people. That's what demosocracy means, rule by the people. The will of the people translated into public purposes of the state. That's what a democratic form of political rule is meant to accomplish. But here's the problem. How do you form a general will of the people, and how do you translate it into public policy? And here's the obstacle. Here's the difficult problem that to actually accomplish that. We live in a highly atomized society of separate competing individuals, each pursuing their own individual interests, facing numerous free rider problems. In that kind of world where everybody lives their separate lives and are preoccupied with solving their individual problems, how do you get people together to constitute a collective will, a will of the people, and how do you translate it into democratic consequences? How do you transform people from simply separate persons going about their individual business into some kind of collectivity capable of forming this idea of the will of the people? The solution to this problem is the formation of various kinds of grassroots organizations that are directly integrated into people's ordinary lives and which help them build a sense of solidarity and collective capacity. The solution is to somehow or other move from a world of just separate individuals going about their own business to a world in which people feel embedded in communities, in associations, in collectivities of different sorts, where they talk to each other, where they think through problems, and in which they develop solidarities and collective capacity. When this happens, it reduces a number of problems that we've already discussed in the class. It solves some information problems, for example. An organization that one identifies with and trusts provides information that makes political choice simpler. It provides a basis for solving problems of mobilization and coordination. If you're part of an organized community, some kind of organization that's embedded, in which your life is embedded in one way or another, the organization provides political resources to get people to the polls, for example. And activation. The organization makes it much easier to get actively involved in politics if you want to. If you're just a separate, isolated person, and you are upset about the way the world is going, and you want to get engaged politically, you want to do something about it, it's much easier if your life is embedded in some sort of associational context where you can easily connect with other people, and in which there are organizations, vehicles for political participation readily available. This idea is connected to a particular way that sociologists think about how a society like the United States is organized, something we've been talking about all semester. So one way of thinking about social life is to think of social life as that you can break it down into three different spheres or arenas of social interaction: the economy, the state, and what is called civil society. The terms economy and the state, I think, are familiar to everyone. Civil society is a less familiar term, but it figures pretty prominently in contemporary discussions of American society, indeed of developed societies more generally. The economy is the sphere in which we produce and buy things. The state is the sphere where we govern our collective affairs. These are kind of shorthand definitions of a more complex problem. Civil society is the sphere in which we get together voluntarily in organizations and associations to pursue common purposes. That's what civil society is. Civil society is populated by organizations. Sometimes people say it's populated by social networks, and networks are a looser kind of organization. A neighborhood that has a dense network of interactions could be thought of as a kind of association within civil society. The entities within civil society are things like rotary clubs, churches, unions, all sorts of Boy Scouts, bowling leagues. There's a famous book by Robert Putnam called Bowling Alone, which is about the decline of bowling leagues in American society. And his argument using bowling as a kind of symbolic example, an iconic example, his argument was that the decline of bowling, not just individual bowling, going out and bowling, but bowling leagues represented a weakening of civil society. It was a loss of occasions in which people got together to interact and talk. Bowling leagues were also a place where people would talk politics, and it would provide this kind of associational life in which you were embedded and could act as a bridge between the individual and broader forms of political participation. So churches are a really important example of that. People go to church not in order to participate in politics. It's a side effect of being a member of a church as an association. It's an association. You get together. You talk. You have connections. There are resources. It's a side effect of going to churches. that it facilitates getting involved in urgent political issues of the day. In the run-up to the Civil War, the abolitionist movement was deeply connected to Northern Protestant churches. And the abolitionist movement was surely one of the important social processes by which anti-slavery increased, why the tensions between North and South escalated, why there was a feeling in the South that in the long term, staying within the Union would not be viable, and why then the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860 triggered the secession of Southern states. If it hadn't been for the social movement that we call the abolitionists, probably might still have ended up with a civil war, but who knows what would have happened. The possibility of figuring out other solutions would have been greater. It was the agitation of politicized opponents to slavery that mattered. And here's the point. That politicization of the anti-slavery movement crucially depended upon churches. The Black Southern Church played an enormously important role in the civil rights era. It's pretty hard to imagine how Southern blacks would have been able to organize opposition to Jim Crow and to segregation if they didn't have a place where they regularly met and talked to each other and organized. And much of the organization was church-based. That's one of the striking features. Martin Luther King was a pastor. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, one of the key organizing, was a Christian organization based in churches. Some of the main events that we think of as part of the civil rights movement, the bombing of the Birmingham Church, the Baptist Church. Why bomb churches? Well, because they were centers of political activity. And today, we see this again in a different form. The role of evangelical Christian churches around socially conservative moral issues, that is a stance based in their religious convictions, has also played an absolutely crucial role in the particular course of political development over the last 30 or 40 years in the United States. Evangelical churches used to abstain from politics. It was seen as a secular concern, but beginning in the 1970s and accelerating in the 80s and beyond, they have become central organizational bases for politics. Well, unions play a similar role. They were a crucial component of the New Deal coalition of the 1930s and the most important basis for mobilized working class politics in the second half of the 20th century. And unions have this special quality. That is, when people go to work, one of the main centers of their life activity is the workplace. Workplaces are places where you interact with other people in a similar situation, facing similar problems in life with similar economic resources. It's a dense site of interaction. Now, of course, that's not true for all workplaces. Some workplaces are tiny, and there may be no co-workers in the most limiting cases. Some workplaces are highly decentralized, and there's very little opportunity for that kind of interaction. But many workplaces constitute one of the centers of a person's life activity. What unions do is take the workplace as a site of social interaction and turn it into a site of associational action. It is a form of association that makes it easy for people who find themselves in a similar circumstance in life with respect to social issues and political problems and economic dilemmas, people who share common interests because of their common situation, it facilitates them acting in concert politically. Well, let's now turn directly to unions. The conventional view of unions is that labor unions are a special interest organization that looks out for the narrow economic interests of their members at the expense of everyone else. this is also, I think one could say, the mainstream view of labor unions among most economists. Not all economists, but certainly many. Let me not say most, because that implies I've done a survey and I know that it's at least 51%. I haven't done such a survey, so it's a conjecture that it's more than half, but it's certainly many economists. They basically believe that unions interfere with the free market. Indeed, that's what unions try to do economically. They try to interfere with the free market. They try to organize labor so that the contracts that get made between employers and workers, employers and their employees, are not made with individual persons. The terms of those contracts are not just bargained individually, they're bargained collectively. And what that does is it obstructs individual free market choice. That's what it does. It says, no, you can't make an individual contract with the employer. We make the contract with the employer. We, meaning the collective organization. So mainstream economists say that's a bad thing. Anything that interferes with the free market is inefficient. It creates rigidities. It's harder for employers to lower wages when they're under competitive pressure, if you have a union. It's harder for employers to fire workers whenever they want, because there are grievance procedures and there are rules that govern the firing of workers. This creates rigidities. And above all, it obstructs the individual's right to make whatever contracts they want. In the end, therefore, the mainstream says, unions make everybody worse off, because unions generate inefficiencies in the market. That's a really parallel to their view that regulations in general of the market interfere with efficiency, because they block profit-maximizing firms and profit-maximizing individuals. People want to earn as much as they can individually. It blocks them from allocating either their capital or their labor in the way that they feel is best. That's the conventional view. The alternative view says that unions help create more equal power. And there are two aspects of this, economic power and political power. The economic power is more straightforward. That's a kind of simple idea that I think is not hard for anybody to understand. Power in a market depends upon how many options one has and how badly harmed you are if you fail to make a deal. You have more power in a bargaining situation if your bargaining partner will suffer more if a deal isn't made. Whoever has the best fallback options has more power in a negotiation. That's a kind of obvious point. I think everybody understands that. In most circumstances, an employer has many potential employees that can be hired for most jobs. Usually it hurts an employee more to be fired than it hurts an employer for an individual employee to quit. Right? It's usually employees have a higher cost of being fired than an employer has a cost of having a particular worker leave. And this means that employers have more power than workers. Unions are the most important way of creating some semblance of equality in bargaining over the employment contract. And that's, in terms of economic power, what unions do. Workers are individually weak in their bargaining with employers, but they can be collectively much stronger. This is reflected in the differences in average wage of union and non-union workers in similar occupation, in the same occupation. This is old data. It's from a study done in the year 2000, which, like many of the statistics in this course, I haven't been able to update this year, but I will before the next time I teach the course. This just illustrates the impact of unions on wages and on poverty in a number of kind of classic low-wage, low-skill jobs. makes a very big difference. And the reason, again, is pretty straightforward. The union creates a bargaining contrast in which the costs to the employer of not working out a compromise, working out a deal, become greater because the employer loses all the employees. If everybody quits, that is, goes on strike, well, that's pretty costly to an employer. Whereas if one person won't take the job because of the wage that's offered, that's not a big deal in many cases, especially in low-wage, low-skill occupations in which it's pretty easy to find alternatives. So that's the first point, economic power. The second point, which is the point that matters for today's lecture especially, is political power. Unions help build solidarity and collective capacity for political mobilization. Isolated, atomized individuals are likely to be passive, apathetic political force. We've discussed this. The problem of rational ignorance will make people easy to manipulate and discourage participation. And in the absence of strong solidarities, people won't have a sense of civic obligation. Remember, as I argued in the discussion of voting, the main reason why people end up voting, the thing that really matters, is that they feel civic responsibility, obligation. That's the kind of person I am. I'm the kind of person that votes because I don't want other people to bear the burden of voting when democracy matters to me. It's a sense of civic obligation. Well, where does the civic obligation come from? One important source of civic obligation is a feeling of solidarity with other people in a similar situation as your own. You feel part of a collectivity in which you identify. Part of your identity is bound up with that collectivity. The labor movement is one of the important ways in which individuals can be brought into politics. And in particular, it's an important way that people can be brought into politics, people who are in what could be broadly understood as the working class, people who work for a living, they get their livelihood by entering the labor market, and they don't have substantial other assets to fall back on. Their main asset by far is simply their ability to work. And that's how they gain their livelihood. So if we understand that broad category of the population as the working class, well, for people in that situation, unions constitute, historically, one of the main ways in which the sense of commonality that you experience within your everyday life of work can get translated into an organizational capacity to act in concert with others, not just to act on your individual motives. Well, let's now look at the historical development of the labor movement. So we're now, that's the general idea. Those comments apply everywhere. That's true for unions in Sweden and Germany, France, Italy, everywhere. Unions have this special relationship because they're connected to workplaces where people live a lot of their lives and form these connections and identities and sense of common interest. Well, unions are the associational link between that aspect of a person's life and their broader political engagement. And that's why I think the analogy with churches is relevant. You know, churches also have that character. People go to church every week, or sometimes more than every week. It's part of their mundane, everyday life. It's built into their life as a important thing to do. It's part of identity. It's a part of sense when you go to church that I'm with people like me, commonality, shared sensibility, shared values. And churches then are an associational context for translating that commonality into collective action. Unions translate workplaces into sites of commonality and potential collective action. Well, let's now look at it historically. Historically, unions encountered a conflict between two crucial values, both of which are legitimate values. So these are real values in American life, These are values that then get translated into political ideologies, and both are important. First, there's the value of freedom of association. People should be allowed to join whatever organizations and associations they like. Joining forces with others to accomplish goals is part of liberal freedoms. It's part of liberty to be able to form associations. But there's another value, which is individual freedom to do whatever you want. Not just join associations, but the freedom of voluntary exchange in markets. Market freedom is basically the freedom of individual choice to engage in any bargain that you can find a suitable bargaining partner, any kind of exchange. Freedom of association and freedom of contract bump against each other. They bump against each other. And historically, in the United States, in the 19th century and well into the 20th century, the freedom of voluntary exchange was seen as more important than the freedom of association. So there was no protection offered to people who would try to form associations to bargain collectively, which would interfere with freedom of voluntary exchange. Here's the problem. Here's why there's a tension between these two ideas, freedom of association and freedom of individual contract. For a union to be strong, it needs a high proportion of workers in a firm to be members. There's strength in numbers. You know, you have an employer that has, you know, 5,000 employees, and if 7 of them are members of a union, they can hardly accomplish anything. If 3,000 are members, then they can accomplish a lot. There's strength in numbers. All unions begin small. I mean, it's kind of a trivial point. If you have a firm that has no union members and you want to start a union, you begin small. You don't just snap your fingers and jump from 0 to 5,000. You begin small. And that's a problem. Can a union grow from small to big, from weak to strong? This is a general problem. It's a kind of interesting problem to think about in general in a society. When we discuss political parties, the two-party system and the first-past-the-post single-member district election system, especially with nicely drawn gerrymandered boundaries, that makes it very hard for a political party to start small and get big. It's hard to grow because of the voting for the lesser evil problem. Third parties can gather enough votes to make to create a victory for a party you like even less. So, you know, the problem of electoral rules of the game make it pretty tough, very, very hard in the United States for small parties to become big. Well, unions face a similar problem. So that's why this is a general issue. How do you, if you have an association that you think is important to accomplish collective goals, how do you grow from small to big? The rules of the game matter a lot. All unions begin as weak organizations. How can they grow from small to big? When a union is weak, individuals are extremely vulnerable to reprisals from employers for joining a union. And this is what makes it so hard to go from small to big. If the employers were benign, if they were indifferent to whether or not a union was formed, and they just abstained from interfering, then if you were small, you could go to work and talk to your fellow workers and try to persuade them about the desirability of unions. You could give them literature about it. And you could one by one recruit additional workers until you were big enough to actually form an effective collective organization. Unless employers are prohibited from reprisals, most employers historically are not benign with respect to this problem. They've strongly opposed unions, and they fire workers summarily when those workers are identified as trying to organize a union. And that was perfectly legal. Until the 1930s in the United States, if you were an employee of a firm and your employer found out that you were trying to form a union, the employer could fire you with at will, could just fire you with no other reason, just simply because you wanted to form an association. This was the situation until the 1930s. So then here's the way of thinking about this problem. That's not quite the same as the government saying unions are illegal. Right? It's not the government saying, if you try to form a union, we're going to send the police and arrest you. But it's pretty close to that if the government says, we won't protect you if you try to form a union. Employers can just fire you at will. It's pretty close to the same thing as having a law on the books which says you can't form unions. You can form unions, but of course you're going to get crushed and fired if you try. We're not going to do anything to interfere with the asymmetrical power relations that workers and employers are in to make it possible to form a union. It's similar to the problem of third parties. We don't have on the books, there's no law in any state that says forming a third party that isn't Democratic or Republican and trying to win elections is illegal. If you try to form a party, it won't appear on the ballot. We will only allow, by law, two parties on the ballot. No, that's not the way it works. We don't have a law prohibiting third parties, but we have rules of the game for how you compete politically that makes it virtually impossible to grow from small to big, except under very peculiar and special historical circumstances. And that was the situation for unions until the 1930s. This makes it very hard for a union to grow slowly and incrementally. You need legal protections that are enforced by the state. And this is a central problem for any labor movement, is how to create a favorable legal framework for union organizing. Again, this is a specific example of the issue of how the rules of the game facilitate or block different strategies. This harkens back to one of the very early lectures in the course. Since we're now careening so rapidly towards the end of the semester, I like to kind of segue back and remind you of where we started. Right at the beginning, I said sociology is really all about rules, how the rules of the game, how the rules of social life are created, and all these different kinds of rules, from norms that we just internalize in our heads to rules that are enforced by the state. And a lot of what we observe as just ordinary everyday activity is actually very deeply rule governed. And the rules, once they're in place, can have all sorts of second order ramifications. The rules of first past the post for elections have this second order ramification of making it almost impossible for third parties to compete effectively. And the rules for how unions are formed has as a ramification whether it's easy or difficult to start small and get big. Well, the big breakthrough in the United States came in the 1930s with an act called the Wagner Act. The Wagner Act. Quite apart from its relevance for this course, you should have that act in your head. You should remember the Wagner Act. Say it 5 times to yourself and you'll remember it. The Wagner Act. The Wagner Act is one of the hallmark pieces of legislation in American history that really changed the rules of the game. It's not that often that you see a piece of legislation introduced in which you can say there's a before and after, right? It's a rupture in the nature of the game itself. You're playing a different game. You know, the game metaphor, I think, is kind of helpful. The Wagner Act is, I suppose, like suddenly changing the rules of a sport in which you have a ball and people running around on a field, changing it from, let's say, I don't know if it's as big as soccer to football. Maybe it's rugby to football or something. The whole game was changed. Figure out your sports metaphor that gets the point across to you. Well, what's the Wagner Act? What did it do? What are its key provisions? First, it created something called the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. It was established to oversee the rules. So you create a set of rules rules aren't self-enforcing. You can create a set of rules, and then if they're violated, you have to go to court, to a conventional court, to get them enforced. Well, that's incredibly cumbersome. And certainly, a worker who gets fired for organizing a union is hardly in a position to then sue the employer in court. No, so what was created was something called the NLRB, this National Labor Relations Board, which oversees the rules, and which in principle makes it easy for workers who feel their employers are violating the rules to file a complaint. And when the NLRB was at its best, when it was working most effectively, it responded in a reasonably quick way to complaints that were filed. So first, create a special government agency to oversee rules. Create a special agency. Ah, that sounds like bureaucracy. Red tape. When you have rules, you have to have procedures. And when you have to have procedures, you have to monitor them. And so it's, of course, true that it's harder. It's no longer quite as simple to hire and fire people once you have rules that govern how you can, what you can do. Second, at the heart of these rules, there's lots of special details, but at its foundational core are protections of workers against being fired for trying to form a union or joining a union. That's the biggie. Now, there's lots of other procedural rules about how elections get carried out to vote for a union, how unions are certified or decertified. Those turn out to also be pretty important. But the bottom line core issue that changed the nature of the game was protections against being fired for trying to form a union. Because that's what enables you to go from small to big. There's also protections against being fired for going on strike. All right, so it's not just enough to protect people from being fired for joining the union. You also need some kind of protections for union actions. There were also, in addition to protections for being fired for forming a union, a whole set of rules about what could be called fair play for union organizers to form a union, and clear procedures for certifying a legitimate union. So there's all sorts of ways that employers could interfere with the forming of unions aside from just firing workers. And the Wagner Act created a whole set of secondary rules. I don't think the details of those are all that, I mean, they're important in the world. I don't think they're all that important for the present purposes. Just know that there were procedural rules that concerned how you can go about forming a union. So you may not be able to be fired for a union. Can you distribute leaflets at work? Yes, you can distribute leaflets at work. If you were not allowed to be fired for trying to join a union, but were fired for handing out leaflets, clearly that's would be a severe restriction on your ability to actually do the work of organizing. And then, and this is the most ambiguous part, employers were required to bargain in good faith when there is a union, and to refrain from unfair tactics against unions once they're formed. That's a much more complicated and difficult part of the whole legislation. How do you exactly know what's good faith and bad faith bargaining? But it's an important thing because it became itself a way of legitimating, of making a legitimate claim. Yes, we have a union. The union has some proposals, and the employer just refuses to take them seriously. What good faith bargaining means is that there's a presumption that compromises can be reached, that neither side should expect to get everything they want, that compromise between the optimal resolution of conflict on either side, compromise between them should be the expected outcome. And when the NLRB worked at its best, and when the union movement was at its strongest, that really was the norm. Meeting in between what was considered the best, the optimal solution for either party. Compromise, not as selling out from a pure position, but compromise as actually the desired outcome. The desired outcome was something that would be acceptable to both parties in between their preferred outcomes. So here's the basic process under these rules in which a union can get formed. First, there's an organizing drive. Organizers try to get employees to sign cards saying that they want to join a union. That's the first step. The organizers could be somebody who was already an employee in the firm. Organizers can also be from the union that exists independently of a particular firm, and they can come to the firm and try to organize. It doesn't have to be an internal person who is the organizer, but it can be. Once a majority of employees have signed these organizing cards, then there's a vote taken to certify the union as a collective bargaining unit. That's the key moment when you move from an organizing drive to the actual formation of the union at a particular workplace. Then once the union has been formed, there is good faith bargaining in principle, where both sides present their proposals and you bargain until you get a labor contract. If you fail to get a labor contract, one of the options is a strike, where the workers in the union vote for everyone in the union to refuse to work until a contract is achieved. The threat of strike is more important than strikes itself. That is, when a union is really powerful and has a large membership, then employers know that unless they engage in good faith bargaining, they're going to face a strike. And therefore, they're more likely to engage in good faith bargaining. To actually go on strike is pretty costly for unions. Workers lose their wages during a period of strikes. Can create great hardship. Sometimes strikes can be very prolonged. So the purpose of unions is not actually to go on strike, it's to threaten strikes. That's how the power comes from, when you have a stable system. During strikes, employers are allowed to have temporary replacements. And that's a big contentious issue. Temporary replacements of during a strike are what unions call scabs. That's a really nasty pejorative term. When the union is on strike and picketing and the employer hires temporary replacements, the term of art that the union movement used to describe such strike breakers, people who cross the picket line in order to work, are scabs. Often in these situations, employers hire immigrants or minorities, recruit workers from poorer regions to come in. So the occasion of strikes with strike breakers and scabs also can be an occasion for really sharp divisions and antagonistic relations among the relevant populations. Employers are not allowed to fire workers while they're on strike. But this is a big ambiguity and difficulty within these rules, and it varies from country to country, how it is in some countries and not others. They're not prevented from replacing. When workers are on strike, they can be replaced with permanent replacements. The temporary replacements can be kept on. And therefore, if a strike loses, workers aren't guaranteed their jobs back. If a strike wins, one of the conditions of settling a strike is always the demand that the temporary replacements be fired, that the permanent jobs be restored. That is one of the, once you go on strike, that's one of the things you demand. The strike is for a wage and reaffirming the employment of the workers on strike. There are countries in which even if a strike loses, the workers on strike are guaranteed their jobs back. That is, you're not putting your job in jeopardy. You can see how that's a change in the rules of the game, which makes strikes more likely. All right, so one way of thinking about rules of the game, there's all sorts of rules. What are the rules that govern strikes? Well, if you're a pro-labor government and you want workers to be able to exercise their power of withdrawal of labor in order to put pressure on employers, then you would add as another little rule, after a strike, even if it's unsuccessful, that is, even if the workers give up, they're guaranteed their jobs back. They can't be permanently replaced. That makes it easier to go on strike. Workers are risking less when they do so. Well, what what happened? Here is the, over time, the percentage of the labor force, the civilian labor force that were in unions up to the 1930s. It varied from around 5% to around 15-17%. You know, it was up and down. More or less hovering around the 10% line. 10% of employees were in unions, and mostly these were in highly skilled craft unions. The American Federation of Labor, AFL, at the beginning of the 20th century, was a union movement. It was a kind of confederation, a federation of union members, of unions that were in the highly skilled crafts especially. The rules change. Wow, it looks like a different game being played. I mean, a rapid, striking increase between 1933 and 1940 with the percentage of the labor force in unions approaching 35% of the labor force. After World War II, the rules change again. We'll discuss the changes in a moment. The rules change again, and under those new rules and under new strategies by employers, the union movement enters into a slow, long, and steady decline. Here's what happened after World War II. The key piece of legislation is called the Taft-Hartley Amendments to the Wagner Act, and it significantly weakened union protections. So all of those favorable rules that were enacted during in the Wagner Act, some of those favorable rules were reversed. An example is in the Wagner Act, unions were allowed to support each other through what were called secondary boycotts. That is, if you were a trucking firm, a trucking union, the Union of Truck Drivers, the Union of Truck Drivers could refuse to cross a picket line if there was a strike. So if there was a strike in a factory that didn't involve truck drivers, it was a strike in a steel factory, the truck drivers that brought supplies into the factory could refuse to cross the picket line. That meant that other unions could support the union by refusing to participate in the economic activity of the firm. So if the Union of Truck Drivers refuses to deliver goods, that means that the steel company can't employ replacement workers because they won't have anything to do. They won't have the supplies needed to work. The Wagner Act blocked secondary boycotts. You couldn't do that anymore. And other rules changed as well. In particular, after World War II, states began to introduce what are called right-to-work laws to prevent automatic union membership for workers in unionized firms. So here's the problem. Here's the issue. You have a firm in which there is a union. You know, more than 50% of the employees of the firm have signed the cards, voted a union, and you have a union that's engaged in collective bargaining. When the union engages in collective bargaining, all workers in the firm, not just the members of the union, get wage increases. All workers benefit. But if you're a member of a union, you have to pay dues. That is, a union needs to hire staff in order to engage in collective bargaining. So you're a new person who's employed in this, you're just hired to work in this firm. And 70% of the workers in the firm are union members, and 30% are not. And you ask yourself, should I pay dues and join the union or not? And you think, well, I'm going to get a pay raise, whether I'm a member or not. But if I join, then I will actually earn less money because I have to pay the dues. Well, I think I'll just be a free rider. Remember our old friend, the free rider problem? It rears its ugly head again. The right to work basically says people shouldn't be forced to join a union if they don't want to. Sounds right. Shouldn't be forced to join a union. Shouldn't be a rule. The union, when it signs a contract, shouldn't be able to have as part of its contract with the employer, and all people employed in this workforce have to pay dues to us. That sounds like a violation of individual rights. Thus, the expression right to work. It means right to work without being forced to join a union. It really should be called right to free ride. What the right to work laws do is make it easy for people to be free riders on the collective efforts of the union to improve their wages and working conditions. Unions do a lot more than just improve wages. They also monitor compliance with occupational safety and health rules. They monitor arbitrary behavior by foremen. They have grievance procedures so that if something bad happens to you at work, you're not just a single individual who has to confront the employer. No, you tell your union, I was abused by this foreman, and the union will file a grievance on your behalf. And if it requires really expensive action, like going to court, the union will do it on your behalf. Those are important collective benefits. Well, right to work means you can get those benefits without having to pay for them. And no audio. Please turn on the microphone. Dead battery. Well, I actually checked the battery at the beginning of the lecture, and it said there were 3 hours left on it. Now we know. Oh, that's better. Was it getting quieter and quieter in the back? Did you notice it drop? No, I guess not. Well, now it's louder, right? It's okay? Is this okay? Got it? Okay, onward. The right to work is the right to free ride. And predictably, you pass right to work laws, what happens to union membership? Goes down. The southern United States passed right to work laws. The southern United States unions were way down compared to the north. But more happened in the decades following World War II. More than just the right to work and Taft-Hartley amendments, there was also increasingly lax enforcement of labor laws. This accelerates especially from the 1980s on, beginning perhaps in the 1970s, but especially starting in the 1980s. The rules on the books simply don't get enforced. The NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is crucial to the whole viability of unions. Well, one way of dealing with unions is to still have an NLRB, but to reduce its staff, reduce its funding, or stack the NLRB with conservatives who don't care about labor law. The end result of this is that in the United States today, wage theft, actual wage theft, that is employers refusing to pay the wages in the contract, is common in some sectors, especially when there is undocumented labor. So it's a very nifty way of being an employer. You hire non-citizen undocumented labor, and then you don't pay them all the wages that are due. Sweatshop conditions have intensified in some sectors because of this. But there is also illegal firing of workers for trying to organize a union. And then the union that they're trying to organize will file a complaint, and the complaint will take years to be dealt with because the NLRB just ignores most complaints. Not officially, but it has a huge backlog. Taking employers to court is impossible for most workers. So lax enforcement of labor laws undermines the viability of unions. And increasingly, there are sophisticated, sometimes really ruthless strategies of employers to undermine unions. Employers used to, in the 1950s and 60s, employers with largely unionized labor forces felt that on balance, having labor peace and having a cooperative workforce that felt it was being taken care of, while it might not be their absolutely preferred choice, they'd rather have complete power to do what they wanted, they both could live with it, and it had some advantages, so they weren't completely discontent. But starting in the 70s, accelerating thereafter, employers decided, when I say employers decided, that's a kind of loose statement, right? So a significant change among employers, not all, but many, was that they actually could go on the offensive and destroy unions. They could actively engage in subversion of unions because they were confident that it would not lead to political backlash. Here are some of the strategies. So a union is trying to organize. You can have mandatory captive audience meetings where you force all workers to come to an auditorium and hear the management tell them of all the terrible things that will happen to them if they join a union. They hire professional anti-union consultants who give them detailed instructions on the best strategies to undermine unions. And the strategies include telling falsehoods about the likely consequences of having a union, just simply perpetuating threats that are unbacked by reality. Threats to move businesses and then deport immigrant workers. One of the reasons why employers like immigrant workers is that the threat of deportation is a terrific anti-union threat. Right, so you hire immigrant workers, not just undocumented, you hire immigrant workers who may have legal residency but still feel vulnerable that they're being fired and government authorities being brought in could lead to their deportation. And then the explicit illegal firing of workers who sign union cards. That's advised by anti-union consultants. They say, fire workers who sign union cards, because what can they do about it? And it'll take years before the complaint. And even if in the end you're fined, the fine that you have to pay if you illegally fire workers is small compared to the costs to you if you have a union. And lacks enforcement of laws by government authorities, as I've already mentioned. And finally, even after union victories, the use of continual aggressive anti-union activity to block grants, contracts. Well, this story occurred nationally. It also played itself out in Wisconsin in the last decade, the last 7 years. Historically, Wisconsin was a state with very strong labor unions. Indeed, the very first public sector union was in Wisconsin, in Madison. You know, this is ground zero for the labor movement in the public sector. The very first public sector union was in Madison. And prior to 2010, we had among the highest proportion of the labor force, both in the public and private sector, that were members of unions. And mostly this worked in a very smooth way. It was not a state with high labor conflict. It wasn't a state in which unions were constantly going on strike. It's just a state that was very well organized. The union movement was strong, and bargaining was a routine part of life, both in the public and private sectors. In 2010, Scott Walker was elected. And I should say, in the run-up to the election, in the fall of 2010, when asked directly about his views about public sector unions, he said he would bargain with public sector unions. It was not part of the election campaign. he didn't run on a platform saying, I plan to destroy the public sector unions in this state. His statements prior to the election was that he would bargain with and recognize public sector unions. Well, in 2010, he was elected. This 2010 was one of these big election swings where the existing parties in many states were changed. In Wisconsin, prior to 2010, the state assembly, the Senate, and the governor were all controlled by the Democratic Party. In my own judgment, a pretty mediocre political regime. The prior Democratic governor, I thought, was pretty lazy and didn't do much. I didn't have any great love for the politics of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin prior to that election, but for whatever combination of national and local reasons, there was a sweep. Solid majorities in the state assembly and the state senate. In February of 2010, what came to be known as Act 10, was introduced in the state legislature. And Act 10 involved a variety of changes in the rules which effectively destroyed public sector unions. Act 10 did not say it is illegal to form a union. Right? So as I said, you don't have to abolish unions by fiat, just having a law that makes them illegal to get rid of them. What you have to do is to create rules that make it extremely hard to form unions. What were some of the rules? One of the rules was this, that unions were prevented from bargaining over any issue besides wages, and they couldn't bargain for wages above the rate of inflation. So you could actually never bargain for a wage increase. All you could bargain for, the most you could bargain for, was wages to keep pace with inflation. That was the most. Second provision, every year you had to have a certification election. Every year. And the percentage of votes you got in the certification election had to be a majority of the employees, not just a majority of the people who voted. So voting in the certification election was voluntary, not mandatory. And the union had to get more than 50% of the total number of employees at the workplace. If you're a teachers' union in Madison, you'd have to get a majority of the votes of teachers in Madison to have a Madison teachers' union, not just a majority of the people who actually voted. I mean, imagine if you had a political election of that character, where in order to get elected president, you had to have 50% of the votes of the total population, of the adults eligible to vote. You know, typically, American presidents get elected with something in the vicinity of 20 to 25% of the vote of the adult population. That is, they get, you know, somewhere around half of the votes that were cast, plus or minus. Roughly half of the votes that were cast, but we only have 50 to 55% of the adult population voting in elections. So they're elected with 20, 25, maybe 30% of the votes of adults. Well, that was another restriction put on unions. That was in 2010. In 2015, Wisconsin became another right-to-work state. We had previously not been a right-to-work state. We had anti-free riding rules for unions, for both public and private sector unions. That is, once a union was certified in a workplace, everybody had to contribute. Everybody had to join the union in order to be employed. On the grounds, on the argument that that was a violation of individual rights, that people shouldn't be forced to pay for a union unless they wanted to, the right-to-work laws were passed in 2015. Well, what were the consequences? Prior to 2010, for the overall labor movement in Wisconsin, We were well above the national average. About 15% of employees in Wisconsin were members of unions, overall public and private sector together, compared to 12% nationally. Now we are well below the national average. And the change for public sector unions is even more dramatic. In 2011, 53% of all state employees were members of unions. Today it's less than half of that. And remember, there are some public sector employees that are exempted from the Act 10 laws. Police and firemen are exempted from those rules, and state troopers. It was one of the interesting features of the protests against Act 10, against these rules that would destroy public sector unions. It was one of the interesting features that police and firemen joined in the protests, even though they were exempted from the rules. This was an example of, I think, a particularly manipulative strategy in the effort to destroy the favorable rules for public sector unions. The only unions that had endorsed Scott Walker in the election were police and fire and state troopers. They had endorsed him in the election. And therefore, when the rules were to be changed to get rid of public sector unions, those unions were exempted. What are the consequences for democracy of this decline of unions? First, it's an absence of a coherent associational basis for a working class electorate. One of the things that the labor movement in Wisconsin did was support candidates who pursued policies, who supported policies which were favorable to ordinary working class voters. Mostly, but not exclusively, that was Democratic Party candidates, because Democratic Party candidates are generally more favorable to lower income and middle income people than are Republican candidates, but not exclusively. There were times when the labor movement in Wisconsin did support Republicans, including Republican governors, and certainly particular Republicans in the assembly and state. Well, the destruction of unions in Wisconsin, and more generally nationally, undermines the capacity for an associational basis for that particular kind of class situation. It reduces pressure on the Democratic Party to focus on working class issues. One of the reasons why the Democratic Party has drifted away from its working class base is in part because the working class base is not organized effectively independently of the Democratic Party in order to put pressure on it. We saw the consequences of that in the last election. The decline of unions in American politics also has reduced the counterweight to the role of money in shaping political agendas. There's really two sources. This is to oversimplify things, and it's part of what you do in lectures. You strip things down to their core. In a way, in a democracy, we can say there's two sources of power: the willingness to pay and the willingness to act, right? So corporations and wealthy people can play a very active role in politics through their willingness to pay. The Koch brothers, these well-known oil tycoons, contribute tens of millions of dollars to conservative politics. They have a high willingness to pay. For ordinary folks, the key source of power they have is the willingness to act. And the willingness to act is a crucial counterweight to the willingness to pay. But you need collective capacity. You have to have this kind of organic associational connection between voters and politics in order to activate that willingness to act. And unions used to be a central basis for that. Unions played a crucial role in mobilizing voters to get out to vote and to facilitate the process by which individuals would feel an identity that linked them to the electoral process. The destruction of unions, of popular associational life that's rooted in ordinary people's lives, the destruction of unions therefore, has reduced the counterweight to the role of money in shaping political agendas. And all of this contributes to what I think can only be described as the slide towards plutocracy. Plutocracy means rule by the plutocrats. It's a kind of fancy term for rule by elites, rather than rule by the people. And unless there's a revitalization of the labor movement or other forms of grassroots popular associations which connect people in their ordinary lives to politics, it's very hard to see how a sustainable willingness to act can be a counterweight to the eager willingness to pay of existing elites. Well, next week we're going to turn to optimism. We're going to be looking at ways in which indeed there are possibilities and in which such activation actually does occur. So if you feel at all gloomy after what we've been discussing most recently, come back for a dose of optimism on Tuesday. See you then.